the great crash of 2008, causes and consequences, I fear that it will very soon be called the great crash of 2009, namely when I crash on this podium. I'm a little bit exhausted by our wonderful evening yesterday, which was then extended throughout the night. And this morning, our good friend Joseph Becker took me out for tennis. And then I realized, I'm no longer 22 or 30, I'm not even 32 anymore. So I'm having a hard time standing here, but the voice is still working. And anyway, so I have a relatively easy subject. Talking about the financial crisis to this distinguished group of Austro-libertarians is like carrying owls to Athens, okay? So it's a home game. I gave similar talks to other audiences that were not as well informed as you are, which allows me to step over some parts of the argument rather quickly. And so I've some experience with the reaction to this. One of the aspects of the present crisis that started in July 2007 and still extends to the present day, one thing that intrigued me was, it starts already, right? Was intrigued that the Austrian interpretation is well received, can be communicated to a larger audience, even in France, which is the country in which I'm presently living and teaching. And if you know something of, about France, as far as economics is concerned, France is distinguished by the fact that it's the only country in which the economists are to the left of the general population. Okay. Or another way of saying this would be where economists know less about economics than the average Frenchman. So, let me first give a brief definition of a crisis. A crisis is a situation in which many investment errors become apparent at the same time. So when I fall off this podium, that's not yet a crisis. It shows that I've done something wrong because I can no longer stand on my feet. But which is an individual error. If an individual company goes bankrupt, that's not a crisis either. It's an individual investment error. And this happens, of course, all the time. We constantly have what Josef Schumpeter once called process of creative destruction. The market economy renews itself. My knowledge of biology is rather limited, which I have to admit is a Professor Duisberg. But even one thing that I remember was that within the human body, also cells are constantly renewing themselves. So part of the cells are dying, other cells are being created. In the economy, it's a little bit the same thing. So this process is not tantamount to a crisis. A crisis is in a situation in which we have a particularly high number of bad investment decisions that become apparent by the bankruptcy of the firms. So the question then is, what explains the crisis? Is there a common cause, or is this just a pure coincidence? Could be a pure coincidence from a logical point of view, but of course that we are interested in finding a common cause, and Austrian economics and Austrian business cycle theory in particular gives us such an explanation of a common cause of all these failures. So what I will do now in my talk is first talk about the causes of the present crisis, and I'll explain to you that we can distinguish two main aspects or two main causal chains. One runs through the fragility, the general fragility of financial markets, and the other one runs through malinvestment. And both causes have an ultimate cause, which is the same, namely the presence of our current monetary system, which is based on paper money or fiat money and central banking. And then in the second part of my talk, I'll come to talk about the consequences of the present crisis. And here I will limit myself to discussing the political reaction that has taken place so far, and then also address some light on the horizon, some libertarian inroads that have been taking place in the context of the crisis. So what are the causes? Again, we can distinguish two main chains. On the one hand, we have the fragility of the financial markets, and then we have malinvestment. The fragility of the financial markets has been known for a long time. So it's not something that became apparent only in July of 2007 when the crisis broke out on the subprime market. And this fragility has two symptoms. One is extremely low cash balances at financial market participants. And the other is extremely low equity ratios. So if you're extremely low cash balance, then of course you run into trouble whenever you need to make a current payment or an unexpected payment, and you don't have enough money in your balance and on your bank account or in your pocket. So banks do have extremely low cash balances. Investment firms, same thing. I always tell my students, if you ever complete failure in your studies, you won't get your degree and you have to become a robber or something else. At least you're strong or something, you can handle a gun, you will become a robber. Don't try to rob banks, right? There's no money in the banks. Don't go to the banks. Go to the next grocery shop or some other place where there's still some, well, banknotes and so on. So banks don't hold much cash, which makes them vulnerable to liquidity crises. And this fragility or vulnerability of any individual bank then tends to spill over to other banks. If one bank has a liquidity problem, it will then try to absorb liquidity from other market participants, thereby reducing the money supply available elsewhere, creating liquidity problems for other market participants, and so on. So there can be a chain reaction, a snowball effect. Same thing for the low equity ratios. As soon as one market participant goes bankrupt, the value of the debts of these firms will fall. So, for example, if you have given a credit to General Motors, you have bought, as some of my relatives have done, General Motors bonds. If General Motors goes bankrupt, well, then the bonds will fall in value because bankruptcy means that General Motors is unable, even by selling all of its assets, the entire, all the plans and the products, the stocks that they have accumulated and so on, if they sell everything, they will not be able to pay back the entire debt. Now, so if this happens, then some other market participant whose assets are the liabilities of General Motors. So you have an investment firm, for example, who has given a credit to General Motors or bought General Motors bonds, will now have a reduction of its asset size. So the assets have a lower value, and therefore this firm in turn will not be able to pay back all its debts, even if it liquidated, if it sold on the market, whatever asset it has on its balance sheets. So there's again a snowball effect coming from this fact. And this is exactly the snowball effect, is exactly what we observed in the months after July of 2007. And we had a crisis that broke out on a rather narrow segment of the market, maybe the so-called subprime market. And from there on, it spilled over to the rest of the market. And it spilled over very quickly and with dramatic dimensions because of the general fragility of financial markets. So to give you an idea, we have several entrepreneurs here, and a typical firm that is not operating on the financial market would hold equity ratio anywhere in between 30 and 100%, okay? Which means that out of all the money that the firm has invested, 30 to 100% is financed by the money belonging to the entrepreneur, and only the rest comes out of debt. On the financial markets, a typical German firm, Deutsche Bank, Commerzbank, etc., operates with an equity ratio of 2%. Okay? And in the US, it's similar. There's been much talk in the media about hedge funds and so on. It's true that hedge funds also operate with very low equity ratios, but it's less dramatic in the case of hedge funds for reasons that I can explain to you if you bring up the question later on. And as a consequence, there was no problem on the hedge fund market, but we did have big problems with banks in Germany and in the US in particular. And of course, cash balances are extremely low. It's less than 1% of the balance sheet is held in form of cash. So we have great fragility here. And this alone, I mean, even if we didn't bring in Austrian business cycle theory, would explain all essential facts about some of the main facts, at least, of the present crisis. And the question then is, why do we have these symptoms? Why do we have such fragility precisely on the financial markets? Why don't we find it in the shoe industry? Why don't we find it in the hotel industry? Why don't we find it in the lamp production or whatever, or microphone production? Why is it on financial markets? So here we then have a couple of non-Austrian, typically wrong explanations, and we have the Austrian explanation. So the typical wrong explanation that we have been offered in the media for the past 18 months was greed. Okay, this is the five-letter explanation, greed. And sometimes one could get the impression that just uttering these five letters was deemed to be sufficient as an explanation why banks and other investment firms were brought to such excesses, why they reduced their equity ratio, why they reduced their cash balances. And indeed, so from a technical point of view, it is some sort of an explanation, right? Because the reason why we hold equity and the reason why we do hold cash balances is to protect us against the risks of business. We hold cash balances to protect us against unforeseen payments that we need to make. And we hold equity to protect us against fluctuations in the demand for our product, of macroeconomic fluctuations that affect the value of our assets, the values of our products, and so on. Let's say you have invested, you have a balance sheet of 100 million euros, which means that you expect that you could sell all your assets, your plant and your machines, your vehicles, and so on, for 100 million euros in a reasonable period of time. And now there is a fluctuation in the demand for your product, which means that you have to downgrade the monetary value of your machines and so on, and you have to cut from, let's say, 100 million to 80 million. If you only have 10 million of equity on your balance sheet, that is, if you have financed these 100 million out of 90 million debt and 10 million equity, and then you have to reduce your balance sheet by 20, so from 100 to 80, you are bankrupt, okay? Because the value of all your assets is only 80 million, and the value of all your debts is 90, okay? So even by selling everything, you could not stay in business. So that's the reason why we hold equity. We hold equity in order to protect us against unforeseen fluctuations in the demand for our product, and therefore, in particular, unforeseen macroeconomic fluctuations that determine the overall price level and therefore the overall aggregate value of assets. So if we therefore neglect to hold sufficient equity, if we neglect to hold sufficient cash balances, in some sense, it's true, it's a sign of greed, okay? Because by reducing our equity, of course, we can increase the return on our own money. We can increase the return on equity. Let's say we might make, for this balance sheet that I just mentioned, we make 10 million profit. Okay, so we have 10 million for 100 million of capital invested, 10% return on investment. Now, that's not the figure that an entrepreneur is mainly interested in. Our main interest goes to see what's the return on equity, what's the return on our own money. Now, if we, let's say, finance 100% of this investment of our own money, we have 10% return. If we finance only 10 million out of these 100 million out of our own money, then of course we would have 100% return. Okay, so there is a monetary incentive to reduce equity as far as possible. There is also a monetary incentive to reduce the cash balances as far as possible, because cash balances are not do not earn any money. Right? So we, rather than keeping the money in our bank account, we can spend it and buy an asset that earns us a return, so we can increase our earnings. So it's true then, just greed is an explanation, right? Certainly, we've been greedy if we reduce our equity, our cash balances in order to increase the return on investment. So greed is an explanation, but it is a very superficial explanation. it is superficial because it doesn't, we still haven't explained why this greed comes to be concentrated in particular on the financial markets. Why aren't shoe producers greedy? Why don't shoe producers produce with 2% equity ratio? Why don't land producers have a 2% equity ratio? Why do we find this only on the financial markets? Yeah, and then of course we get various pseudo-psychological explanations. According to some economists, and this species is very widespread in France, the financial markets, people who are having to deal with money, they are particularly prone to be greedy. And so if you do produce nice things such as glasses and watches and water cans and so on, you're a nice guy and you're just producing whatever is natural, as an Aristotelian philosophy. But as soon as you touch money, you turn into the vampire. Right? So you forget everything else. But this still would not be a sufficient explanation because there is some other element here too, because this is a risky strategy. Right? Of course, we can increase our monetary earnings, but there are also greater risks. So on top of this, we need to postulate that suicidal tendencies are particularly widespread on the financial markets. So you see, I mean, we were drawn into all kinds of psychological or pseudo-psychological explanations or hypotheses, rather, because there is no thorough comparative psychological study of financial market participants as compared to other industries. Maybe some research will come up with this, but so far it's just a hypothesis. It's not an explanation. One of the more sophisticated wrong explanations stresses asymmetric information between market intermediaries and the customers. So the ultimate question then is, why do the customers, why do private capitalists who have money on hand, who have savings, why do they invest on the financial markets? Why do they buy stocks of companies with very low equity ratios? Why do they hand their money over to investment firms that pursue such risky investment strategies? And here the explanation that we often find in economic literature stresses that the customers are relatively less informed about the risks of the products as compared to the financial intermediaries. Right? So we have the vampires, the greedy guys and so on, who do all these nasty things in order to prop up their return on investment. And the customers are the poor sheep. And, just have a few billion dollars spare and put this on the market. They don't really know what's going on. And so their ignorance is being exploited by the financial market professionals. Now, to some extent, this explanation is true, of course, because we do have asymmetric information. Certainly, as in all fields, the professionals are better informed or tend to be better informed than the lay people, than the final customers. But this we have, of course, also in other industries, right? Few of us understand the precise operation of our computer. Still, we use computers. Few of us can repair their own cars or even understand how a car works precisely. And still, we buy cars, we sell cars. We're not being ripped off. So why should this be fundamentally different on the financial markets? The Austrian explanation solves these logical problems and stresses the impact of monetary policy and of the monetary system, more generally speaking. So we have a monetary system based on fiat money, which is the money that is being imposed on the economy, which profits from monopoly, which profits from legal tender laws. And the whole point of having a fiat money is, of course, to facilitate public finance. And it's easier for the government to get additional credits if you can produce as much money as you want and hand it out in the form of credit to the government. That's the historical reason why we have created the system. Other explanation, other rationales have been created a little bit later, and we need monetary policy for the macroeconomic management of the economy. We need monetary policy to promote employment and therefore economic growth and so on, but these were rationales that were invented later. So we have monetary policy. Our monetary systems are based on fiat money that is cheap to produce, typically paper, typically or electronic money, and which therefore, from a technical point of view, can be produced in unlimited quantities and can be produced at virtually no notice. So it's from a technical point of view, it would be possible to increase the money supply from one day to the other by 100-fold or 1,000-fold. There is no technical limitation. And there's also no commercial limitation. A central bank, which produces paper money and electronic money, cannot go bankrupt. You can go look up the websites of the European Central Bank or the Bundesbank. Very well done. They're wonderful websites. They give you also their balance sheets. So you get the impression that it's a regular company because they have a balance sheet, right? Their assets on the one hand, I need to show it for you, their assets on the one hand and their liabilities on the other hand. And so they could go bankrupt, right? I mean, there are debts. If the debts are higher than the assets, they would be bankrupt. Well, the problem is that this is accounting hocus pocus, okay? It's an illusion. The debts of the central bank are in fact the bank notes and the demand deposits issued by the central bank. So it's these things, in fact. Right? This is Turkish money. This is a liability of the Turkish central bank. But what does it mean? Can you turn this in something? Can you claim a payment for this? If you show up at the counter of the Turkish central bank and say, well, I want to have my money. Well, first of all, they will not understand what you want. And then if you insist a little bit, well, they might hand you over another 10 lira banknote, right? Or five. Do you want two fives? Or they won't cut in half a 20, but yeah. So that's the nature of paper money, that you cannot redeem in something more fundamental. If you can redeem it in something more fundamental, you don't have a paper money. Right? It's the characteristic feature of paper money or of electronic money that you cannot redeem it into something more fundamental. Therefore, the bank can never go bankrupt, and it can therefore produce as much of those without ever encountering a commercial problem. So in the presence of this central bank, then, which produces a paper money, it is... there's a strong incentive for all financial market participants to reduce their cash balances. There can be, in fact, no more liquidity crisis because the central bank can lend at a moment's notice any amount of money needed to make the bridge, needed to fill up the cash balances of the companies, and therefore prevent a financial liquidity crisis, which they have done. And as a consequence, financial market participants have reduced their cash balances. So that's the explanation of the low cash balances. But it also explains the low equity ratios. Because what central banks do is to pursue the mission of stabilizing the price level. Right? That's enshrined in the constitution of the Federal Reserve, of the European system of central banks, and of each national central bank. They pursue a policy of price level stabilization. And often in the case of, for example, the Federal Reserve, there's a second objective, which... is macroeconomic stabilization. So what this means, ladies and gentlemen, is that the central banks, well, because they have the power to stabilize the price level, in particular, they can prevent downswings of the price level and therefore downswings of the aggregate monetary value of assets being held with the companies. This implies that for each individual company, therefore, there is a reduced incentive to hold equity. And that's what we said before, the only reason why we hold equity at all, rather than benefiting from the leverage effect to increase the return on our equity, is because there is the risk of downward movement of the value of our assets. If this risk is reduced by the presence of monetary policy, then of course there's a reduced incentive to keep as much equity as in other industries. So central banks have the mission to stabilize the economy, but we have here a classic case of unintended consequences, right? the objective result of their policy of stabilization is to destabilize financial markets. So we have here destabilizing stabilization policies. Why does nobody see this? Why does nobody talk about this? Well, this is it's an interesting question. Therefore, I also found Professor Duisberg's talk on Friday so interesting. In the case of economics, monetary policy in particular, nobody talks about this because the debate is from the outset confined to the hypothesis that we need to keep a central bank. So we cannot question the necessity of a central bank. The entire debate that takes place in the professional journals concerns technical issues of monetary policy given the presence of a central bank. And we need a central bank, again, historically, as I've said, because government, it's a very important instrument for government finance. So nobody talks about the elephant that stands in the middle of the room. It's the central bank. In the professional journals, nobody talks about this because most people writing on monetary economics in the U.S., for example, are actually employed by the Federal Reserve. Okay, the Federal Reserve employs as many economists, so writing on monetary policy issues, as the top 50 departments, economics departments in the U.S. combined. Okay. 75% of all scientific papers published in the professional journals have been either authored by a Federal Reserve employee or have been funded by Federal Reserve money or directly or indirectly. So I give these figures not to say, well, they all our colleagues in the U.S. are corrupt, but it's also naive to assume that such a massive financial presence would have no impact on the kind of research that is being conducted and the kind of conclusions that is that are being reached. So our monetary system destabilizes financial markets, so it explains the fragility of the financial market. It explains, therefore, the snowball effect that we have observed in the past 18 months. But the problems that we had were not only a problem relating to the fragility of financial markets, we also had a problem of malinvestment. And that's the subject, of course, of Austrian business cycle theory, which explains to us that a policy of easy money that decreases the interest rate below the level it would have reached in equilibrium tends to create to incite investment, more investment projects than would have taken place otherwise, and that this must result ultimately in an economic crisis. So the idea is, from a macroeconomic point of view, that the number of investment projects that we can successfully conduct, that we can bring to completion, therefore, which will turn out consumer goods, depends on the availability of real factors of production, real resources. So in particular, labor, right? The amount of people, laborers available in the country, their knowledge, and so on, human capital, but then also real factors of production like vehicles and streets, plants, machines, etc. So this determines how much we can produce. What the monetary policy of easy money does is to incite the launching of more investment projects than can be ultimately realized, can be brought to completion with the available real resources. So we get malinvestment. And that's the great subject of the Austrian business cycle theory that has been first formulated by Ludwig von Mises in 1912. And certainly we had malinvestment of this sort also in the present crisis, which had a few particular features, in particular two. So we had, on the one hand, the length of the preceding boom, so the length of the period during which the interest rate was too low. And it started with the dot-com boom in the late 1990s, and then immediately afterward we had real estate boom in the United States. And the second particular feature is the international dimension of the crisis. So it was not confined in an individual country. We had something called globalization in the past 25, 30 years. So as a consequence, there is an international division of labor that has been created, from which we have greatly benefited. But which makes also that the malinvestment that have been taking place, that is the investment that should not have been made but were made under the impact of easy money, concern all countries all over the world. So as a consequence then, we have now the situation in which we have a scarcity of capital. There's not enough real resources available now to bring to completion all the projects that have been started, and this on an international level. So that's the basic fact that one needs to keep in mind about when it comes to addressing the present crisis, and which unfortunately has not been kept in mind by virtually all economists except for the Austrians. And the Austrians are the reason is that only the Austrians have kept up the tradition of analyzing the capital structure of the economy. Okay, it's simply a question of a neglect of an important subject by most of the other economists. So what are then the consequences of the financial crisis in the light of this fact? We have the political reaction on the one hand, and then some libertarian inroads. The political reaction will be very brief because I'm running out of time, has mobilized the two traditional tools of macroeconomic management, namely monetary policy on the one hand, and budget deficit spending on the other hand. Monetary policy turned out to be very quickly to be inefficient for a simple reason that traditional monetary policy, at least, consists in giving short-term credit to market participants. Now, if you're faced with a widespread or large-scale bankruptcy crisis, which companies are simply bankrupt, so their debts are larger than their assets, it doesn't help them if you give them an additional credit, right? If your assets are of the value of 50 and you have to pay debts of 100, it doesn't help you if the central bank comes along and gives you another credit of 50, right? I mean, your assets grow up, but the balance, your debts go up as well. You're not really being helped. So this became especially obvious last summer, late summer, September, October 2008. Traditional monetary policy was hapless. So there was a glorious return of Keynesianism, right? Keynesian deficit spending. And from a technical point of view, Keynesian deficit spending can address the bankruptcy, at least of individual companies, because what deficit spending allows the government to do is either to buy the products of the company, therefore propping up the value of their assets, or it allows the government to buy shares in the company, so propping up their equities. Now, this was then presented as a macroeconomic approach for solving the crisis, but it is not. And one of the main criticisms that can be made of Keynesianism is precisely that it's not macroeconomics, it's partial industry level economic analysis. The problem is that we don't have enough capital on an aggregate level. So if you're propping up individual companies, you can do this with deficit spending. You don't solve a macroeconomic problem. You just take capital out of other companies. So by solving the situation, solving the bankruptcy problem for some companies, you are creating additional problems for other companies. So that's the situation in which we are being right now. There were a few libertarian inroads. Our staunchest ally, as always, was the real world, okay, reality. And that's the reason why Austrians have been heard in the media, even in France. So even I had some media presence in France. I was on the radio and wrote a couple of newspaper articles and so on. I've been invited to do this. And some of my other colleagues have regular TV appearances and so on. And the reason is that Austrians are able to explain what's going on, whereas most other economists don't have a clue. And the remedies that they recommend don't work. So we have a foot in the door and can spread Austro-libertarianism, which is a good thing. One of the most encouraging aspects of this foot in the door and spreading the message is the burgeoning debate on the gold standard, right, the reintroduction of the gold standard. So about a year ago, Austrians were the only ones who were calling for some sort of a reintroduction of a commodity monetary system. And we are, of course, we were being laughed at. Meanwhile, amazing things have happened. At the Davos Economic Forum, there was a workshop on precisely this problem, reintroducing a gold standard. The Economist, the Financial Times have been publishing articles on this subject, Manager magazine in Germany, and even in France, in the Swiss press, there have been articles on precisely this problem. So there are signs of hope. We can therefore conclude that the great crash of 2009 could be avoided. I've not fallen on this podium. The great crash of 2008, contrary to the presentation that usually left-wing economists give, is not a sign of a market failure. It's a manifestation of a gigantic political failure, in the course of which we are now experiencing a certain institutional deterioration because, well, we are nationalizing the economy, government pumping money into companies, buying companies to prevent them from going bankrupt, thereby turning the economy into a totalitarian scheme. And on the other hand, well, there is some light on the horizon, right? There is a possibility for us to spread the message, and that's what I've been doing, and many others as well. Some are in this room, and I think that's what we need to keep doing in the coming months, in the coming years, to prepare the public for the next crisis, right, in 2030. See you then.